This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Too often, every new leader has to assert their green credentials by announcing a brand new energy policy, and often in their own name. Or in the case of Donald Trump, of course, and Malcolm Turnbull of Australia, they announced their black credentials by dismantling energy policy of their predecessors. The trouble is, with each political change, we lose a lot of time we don't have. That's both a warning and advice contained in a letter published December 7th in the journal Nature. I think this matters. Our guide is a co-author of this telling comment in Nature, Professor Laura Diaz-Anadon. Laura is a professor of climate change policy in the Department of Land Economy at the University of Cambridge. Anadon holds a PhD in chemical engineering from Cambridge and a master's degree in public policy from the Harvard Kennedy School, where she's also a research associate. She has advised governments, United Nations agencies, and many large institutions and corporations. Laura, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex, for having me.
You know, I avoid large-scale policy discussions, but your paper talks frankly about the ways politics can interfere with the need to decarbonize. Who organized this comment for publication and why?
I have been working since 2008 from my time at the Harvard Kennedy School with a group of people, my co-authors in that paper, about what can governments around the world do to accelerate the development and deployment of low-carbon energy technologies. And what we've realized over the past 10 years or so is that we have a growing amount of evidence regarding what works and what doesn't in terms of government programs. So with the work that my colleagues and I had done, focused on various countries, mainly the U.S., but more recently also the U.K., China, and other countries, we realized it was time to try to pull together what we had learned collectively.
Lately, North Americans have heard a little too much about Donald Trump politicizing energy policy and climate change. So why don't you tell us the history of UK leaders from Blair onward announcing their programs?
The comparison with the UK is interesting because here in the UK, the controversy is not about whether or not climate change exists, is real, and we should do something about it. The history in the UK and the volatility in policy in the UK is more about the how. So here there's agreement that there's a problem and that the UK government should do something, but there has been a lot of volatility in terms of the government funding and programs to address the problem. So starting with Tony Blair, in 2001, he created the UK Carbon Trust, which was funded to do all kinds of things. It worked as an incubator, as a grant program, as a mentoring system, doing audits. So it was a significant organization. They were tracking progress. And what happened is that once David Cameron took over, they completely reduced the funding for the Carbon Trust and created the catapults, which were a completely different type of policy to address the threat of climate change. I could give you several other examples of institutions that were created in the UK to address climate change, but basically the thrust of the issue is that different political leaderships created their own institution, funding mechanism, research lab to advance competitiveness and low-carbon energy technologies while reducing, defunding the previous institution without really looking into what that previous institution had delivered. And what I would argue, and I've done some work on this, is that in the case of the Carbon Trust, they were doing a lot of great work. And we have evidence in terms of CO2 emissions reductions, in terms of technologies on the market, in terms of energy efficiency improvements. So the scaling down of the UK Carbon Trust, as an example, is one that cannot really be attributed to their failure to meet goals.
I think governments do need to take a lead. What has been the story of funding for energy innovation in the United States?
So this is also an area I've been working on for the past 10 years. In fact, my colleague Kelly Sims Gallagher, who is now at Tufts University, and myself have maintained a database that is at the Harvard Kennedy School right now. So we've been tracking this since 1978. And basically what we see is that the U.S. Department of Energy funding for energy research, development, and demonstration was at its peak in the late 1970s at around $9 billion in 2015 dollars. This is not surprising because it was in the wake of the oil crisis, so there was a lot of concern about how to develop alternatives, domestic alternatives to imported oil. And what happened then is that during the Reagan administration, of course, oil prices were lower, and also there was this different government approach that that believed that markets would take care of innovation to a greater extent. So funding went down significantly by about 60-70%. So funding was more around $3 billion, government funding, that is, until around 2006. And then it started increasing, most recently, of course, during the two Obama administrations. So now we're basically at around $6 billion, so we're nowhere near the peak. And what you might have heard, and a lot of your listeners might have heard, is that the Trump administration has proposed a very significant reduction in U.S. government funding for energy research and development. In fact, depending on how one measures it, if you look at the overall funding, it's around a 35% proposal, but if you look at the more kind of targeted energy research and development, it's about a 57% cut. And this includes, by the way, zeroing out some of the institutional innovations that were created during the first Obama administration, most prominently the following recommendations from a very influential report, the Rising Above the Gathering Storm. Partly with stimulus funding, the Obama administration created ARPA-E, which is an agency that was modeled after DARPA, which is the you know, famously known as the government agency responsible for a lot of the innovations we have in our iPhones, to internet and so forth. So the Obama administration created ARPA-E. And similar to the story of the Carbon Trust, ARPA-E has been reviewed independently and also by the national academies. There's a report. So in spite of the fact that there's a broad agreement across analysts, independent analysts, that it was an agency that was being promising, already producing some results, although, of course, with innovation we have to wait, but it's, you know, the early indicators were good, then the Trump budget proposal is to completely eliminate this agency, which was receiving around $300 million per year. So we do see some similarities in terms of the government, different administrations' approaches to dealing with institutional innovations from previous administrations. But the one thing I will add is that in terms of U.S. government funding, I talked about how in the late 80s, the U.S. government was funding around $9 billion. During the 80s and 90s, it was around $3 to $4 billion. Now we're around $6 billion. All analysis, all papers, experts, commissions, including my own work, suggest that a much, much bigger, in the orders of 2, 3, even 10 in some cases, orders of magnitude greater would be granted in terms of not just the ability of these investments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but also to reduce energy costs and improve competitiveness. So this $6 billion that we're in right now, and that's not including the proposed cuts in the Trump budget, all analysis suggests that much bigger government investments in energy R&D would be beneficial for U.S. citizens.
We have to wrap up now. Is there anything else that I've missed that you would like to tell our listeners?
These investments are what is going to make a difference in both our ability to meet the climate challenge, but also providing, increasing opportunities to people in the U.S. So I think it's this the economic argument for investing in R&D, even though some programs will fail. And I think, in addition to, we need to invest more. And one of the reasons we need to invest more is also competitiveness, the U.S. competitiveness. I think the third thing is that, yes, we need to invest more, but we also need to learn how to fail. So one thing that we do talk in the article that often gets forgotten both by people in policy but also the public is that innovation is unpredictable. We don't really know ahead of time what particular technologies are going to succeed, and innovation takes time. But without the willingness to take these risks, then we wouldn't have the internet, we wouldn't have, you know, solar cells, we wouldn't have, you know, fracking, for example, which again, for, you know, there's the impact of fracking on climate is one where we can have a whole other discussion, but government programs should be willing to take risks and be able to tolerate failure, which means that we need to learn from those failures. So I think that's the last point, that whenever we hear about some of the arguments against government funding for energy, we hear, oh, there was this program and it failed, and then this program and it failed, and that's really not an argument that I think should carry the day, because without failures we wouldn't have successes. I think the important thing, and the point we make in the article, is that there needs to be a process to learn from these failures. And this is the adaptive learning point that I mentioned, which requires collecting information on a regular basis, evaluating progress, and being willing to change, but based on evidence and not on political changes.
From Cambridge University, we've been speaking with climate professor Laura Diaz-Anadon. She is co-author of a new comment in the journal Nature titled Six Principles for Energy Innovation. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock, Laura.
Thank you very much, Alex.
We're out of time for this week. I am Alex Smith. Please tune in again for the great drama of our time on Radio EcoShock. Thank you for listening.